Good afternoon. You're listening to the Living Writers Show on WCVN FM Ann Arbor. This is 88.3. My name is Ashley David, and my guest today is Jonathan Franzen, author of three novels, The 27th City, Strong Motion, and most recently, The Corrections. He is also the author of a collection of essays called How to Be Alone. He's received numerous honors and awards, including the National Book Award for his most recent novel, The Corrections, and is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. Please welcome Jonathan Franzen. Well, we're going to ask you to start out the show, as we usually do, with a reading, but of your fiction from your most recent book, The Corrections, if you will.
Do I need to set the scene in any way, or can I just start speaking?
How would you like to set the scene a little bit?
Oh, I could say it's a conversation between a somewhat obstreperous son and a depressive old father who disagree about almost everything. And I think they've been talking about, the upcoming Christmas. And the first speaker is Gary, and you'll be able to identify him, I hope, by the somewhat more heated, strident tone of voice that I use for him, and the more grumbly, depressive voice of the father will, I hope, identify him. I have to go first, and now I'm ready. Are you happy with your life? Gary said, waiting for a left-turn arrow. Can you say you're ever happy? Gary, I have an infliction. A lot of people have afflictions. If that's your excuse, fine. If you want to feel sorry for yourself, fine. But why drag Mom down? Well, you'll be leaving tomorrow. Meaning what? Gary said. That you'll sit in your chair and Mom will cook and clean for you? There are things in life that simply have to be endured. Why bother staying alive if that's your attitude? What do you have to look forward to? I ask myself that question every day. Well, and what's your answer? Gary said. What's your answer? What do you think I should look forward to? Travel. I've traveled enough. I spent 30 years traveling. Time with family? Time with people you love? No comment. What do you mean, no comment? Just that, no comment. You're still sore about Christmas. You may interpret it however you like. If you're sore about Christmas, you might have the consideration to say so, no comment. Instead of insinuating, we should have come 2 days later and left 2 days earlier, Alfred said. That's all I have to say on the topic of Christmas. We should have stayed 48 hours. It's because you're depressed, Dad. You are clinically depressed, and so are you. And the responsible thing would be to get some treatment. Did you hear me? I said, so are you. What are you talking about? Figure it out. Dad, really, no. What are you talking about? I'm not the one who sits in a chair all day and sleeps. Underneath you are, Alfred pronounced. That's simply false. One day you will see. I will not, Gary said. My life is on a fundamentally different basis than yours. Mark my words. I look at your marriage. I see what I see. Someday you'll see it too. That's empty talk and you know it. You're just pissed off with me and you have no way to deal with it. I've told you I don't want to discuss this. And I have no respect for that. Well, there are things in your life that I have no respect for either. It shouldn't have hurt to hear that Alfred, who was wrong about almost everything, did not respect things in Gary's life. And yet it did hurt.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Now, in an interview in Bomb magazine with your friend Donald Antrim, you said something like, I feel like the novelist's vision is engaged in a turf war with the scientific, biological, medical account. There's depression that runs through, is a theme that runs through the corrections. And I'm wondering if this sort of assertion you made in the interview with Antrim has anything to do with some of the themes that are running through the book. If, in fact, you're worried about this turf war and sort of having it out in the context of fiction with depression.
Yeah, one of the frustrating things about letting a book go out into the world is that you have to let people read it the way they want to read it. I thought in this long section about Gary, who we just heard speaking, that I was having some fun with the notion of depression. following the way it's often used nowadays in relationships where one person accuses the other of having a mental illness. You're depressed. No, you're depressed. And you resist admitting that you're depressed because that will be a victory for the other person. And if the other person's not being very responsible about it, maybe you are depressed, maybe you're not depressed. Anyway, it's not at all clear that Gary is depressed to me. He exhibits certain symptoms that he worries about morbidly. At the same time, he's actually functioning rather well, and it could be simply that he's under an enormous amount of stress for really pretty reasonable reasons in his life, and that that this whole notion of depression has been introduced in a kind of warlike way by his wife and by his father. What I was thinking when I was writing it was, let's just complicate this. There's this sort of incredibly vulgar notion with proponents like Peter Kramer and Andrew Solomon that you're either depressed or you're not. And if you are, that's the end of the discussion. Medicate, medicate, medicate. Obviously, if you are massively depressed, if you are disabled by depression, you should get some help. And yet, for most of us, it's a much grayer area. And when you come in with this vulgar materialist view of it, you wipe out whole fields of ambiguity and potential interesting conversation. So that's a long answer to the question, although it's a shorter answer than it could have been.
We'll just keep on going. Well, it's a perfectly appropriately sized answer. How's that?
Ashley started out by showing you the signals for that's enough. That's enough right now. Stop.
And I didn't give any of those signals just now. I let him run as much as he wanted to.
I was looking over expectantly, though, sort of anticipating one of those signals.
No. You're doing just fine. It's interesting to me, this notion of flattening, and that's why I asked you the question. The world of the novel and the creative act of writing one, or writing sort of generally, is to open things up. And even in academic writing, I teach my freshmen nuance, nuance, nuance. And I find that they come back to me with nuance, but X plus Y equals Z.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that potentially this kind of medicate, 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 it is clinical depression, is sort of symptomatic of this moment where in this country we have a really important need for X plus Y to equal Z or equal something very concrete and not complicated and nuanced. And that's very much different from what you do in your work. It's all about finding ways to complicate and not oversimplify, not flatten. Is that a struggle?
No, I feel like I'm helplessly vulnerable to the complicatedness of the world, and I want to inflict the discomfort I feel over that on other people. And if I can package it in entertaining narratives, then I stand a better chance of inflicting my discomfort on people who... Actually, that's the way I used to think of it.
Back when you were angry before.
Back when I was angry, yes.
Before you learned how to be alone.
Yes. There is some impulse like that at work always, but... really, what I should say is that I don't think novels are written for people who need the news in them. I think novels are written for people who feel alone with the way they feel about the world, and I'm just writing down the way things appear to me. And I appreciate as a reader when someone takes the trouble to notice that things are complicated and to notice the contradictions that we all walk around with all the time. Because when I'm watching TV, when I'm watching CNN, when I'm listening to most radio, when I'm reading most publications, I feel incredibly alone with how frustrated I am by the oversimplifications. And so, you know, a writer like Joan Didion will do an essay, and it's like, thank you for making me feel like there are at least two of us who look at the world this way. Yeah, that's the new kinder version of inflict my discomfort on a comfortable world.
Do you think the world really is that comfortable? I mean, obviously, you know, if Didion can write, and at least when you, I actually also read Didion and go, thank goodness, there's someone else. Do you think that the world really is that comfortable, or is the medicate, or watch TV?
Well, this gets at, I think, what one of the dirty secrets of reading and writing, which is that, to paraphrase Flannery O'Connor, people without hope don't read fiction. People without hope don't want to have an experience of any kind, and reading a novel is a way of having an experience. So I think it actually, the dirty secret is that people, you have to be sort of okay to write or read an interesting book. It is a marker of privilege, and those people who accuse literature of being an elitist pursuit are right, in a way. If you have a really, really lousy life, you're not going to want to come home and read Kafka. You know, my God.
Not so much.
My God. Yeah. You know, an exception to that are people in prison, who are an interesting exception, who I hear from quite a bit via reader mail. They're an interesting exception both class-wise, because there are a lot of people who came to reading not at all, who are in prison, who came to reading not at all through their upbringing and the opportunities they had as children, but only as adults. And it's this kind of revelation. But of course, they also have a lot of time and a boring existence. But generally speaking, it is, you know, I feel like I have the luxury of being uncomfortable, and I can open myself up to the variety of answers to the questions one might pose, in a way that if I had a harder life, I don't think I would be able to.
But what about, I mean, there are loads of upper middle class folks out there, middle class folks out there who prefer not to read, and have the luxury of.
One of the things I like about fiction and about literature in general is that it doesn't correlate particularly well with socioeconomic status. It's a different kind of privilege. There are plenty of people who are, you know, if you're trapped trying to make your mortgage and your payments on the boat and make partner and all of that, you don't have room for it in the same way that, you know, a grad student who might not have any money and might not come from a particularly privileged background nonetheless has a certain kind of leisure and has a certain kind of opportunity to engage questions that a person in more desperate circumstances, and it's strange to call someone making $200,000 a year desperate, but the country is full of them,
yeah,
might have.
Well, and desperation is a personal experience, if not an objectively sort
exactly.
of...
Exactly. And this is all about, right. So it's a weird kind of privilege, and it's a weird kind of elite that hangs around at crummy used bookstores buying tattered 99-cent paperbacks. That's the kind of elite I'd want to belong to.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Living Writers Show on WCBN FM 88.3. My name is Ashley David, and my guest today is Jonathan Franzen.
Wanna
we're back. You're listening to the Living Writers Show on WCVN FM. My guest today is Jonathan Franzen. We're talking about, well, we started out talking a little bit about his book, The Corrections, which is the most recent novel. And we've sort of gone from there to reading and privilege and that sort of thing. I wonder if from reading and privilege, we could talk about taste and complacency.
Taste and complacency. Yeah, I mean, I worry about the level of abstraction we're sending out at drive hour, but sure.
It's a very educated populace we're talking to.
If we haven't lost you already, yes.
You're still there.
I'm still here. I'm still living and still talking to Ashley. Taste, complacency.
Complacency, yeah. What I'm getting at, I've been reading a bit lately about some of the founding ideals of this country and the notion that we need to educate a citizenry to create this great nation, as some of the rhetoric of our early lit mm-hmm. public discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that we've done a pretty good job of educating the populace overall. We have a fairly highly educated populace relative to other countries around the world, if you will, if you go sort of all the way through. And
yeah, we're about 21 on the list.
We're about 21 on the list.
And there, well, you can call about 180 nations. So yeah.
So we're not.
If you get rid of Western Europe, we're doing really well.
Well, yeah, there are all kinds of qualifications, but I'm trying not to be in that little angry space at the moment.
Okay, we're doing a great job. People are getting great educations here.
Well, just bear with me for this a second, and then we'll tear it all apart. Because what I would like to do is tear it all apart. Despite the fact that we have this sort of privilege of education here and we have this founding ideal of education, we seem to have educated ourselves into a place that is, well, as long as I can get a better job and live the life of my parents or the life better than my parents and own the things I'd like to do, own the things I'd like to own, that I don't really care about it beyond that. So the upper middle class 200K person example,
the desperate 200K. The desperate wealthy man.
Exactly, the desperate wealthy man with his yacht and his mortgage payments has sort of put himself there and worked the spaces of out of his life, the leisure out of his life in a sense. And I wondered whether you think that that's an inevitable move in this democracy that is founded on both social and political democratic ideals and yet seems to be more operating on capitalist ideals at the moment?
Well, I think the jury is still out on the free market system. I don't think it's any accident that, I mean, Western Europe has nothing but problems. They do, those countries do have, I think, a healthy skepticism about the free market and are a little bit better, in my view, at tempering some of the excesses. If you reduce a country to the pursuit of gratification, the pursuit of the means to gratify yourself, and that is the basis of your economic system, it's going to last only a generation or two. And I sort of feel as if our technological prowess, our economic advantages, were sort of like the highways that the Romans built, and then, you know, they were useful to the barbarians for a couple of decades to ride into Rome and sack it. But without the collective will to maintain that system, and without the structures to do that, then the whole thing won't last long. One hears a lot about the export of skill jobs to South Asia, and particularly when it comes to science and technology, which is, after all, at the heart of our current prosperity. That kind of training and education we're particularly falling behind in. At the same time, you know, we could cut what we have in half, and it would still be not a bad life compared to most lives anywhere else. And I would say in the meantime that it's weird to find myself criticizing the U.S. at all, because when I'm in Western Europe, I pine for home.
What the is writing, it you pine for?
The writing is so much better here. The TV is so much better here. People are funnier. And the country is so much more diverse, and you can be surprised so much more easily here, because it's just, it's an insane place. And insane is one of my favorite words to, it's a word I use almost exclusively as a compliment. In my own writing, I feel like when I can say, God, this is insane, I'm getting somewhere. And that's, it's possible to worry about what's going to become of the country. At the same time, there's no place I'd rather live. But that's a hopelessly abstract conclusion to have come to. How does that connect with taste?
Well, I was wondering if instead of cultivating a taste that's sort of high art and education and a discourse that is more like Western Europe, we are rather courting a taste that is characterized by a low culture that includes things like consumption. I mean, it's sort of the more I consume, that is an aesthetic, if you will, and not just.
I am not particularly concerned about that myself, because, again, it's a huge country, and even if it's a tiny percentage of people who care about the kind of cultural products I enjoy, the gross numbers are still pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can get 1% of the country reading you, you've got 3 million readers. In terms of a critical mass for preserving certain modes of cultural expression, I'm not concerned at all. I think literacy is a worry, though. If you don't know how to write, if you don't know how to organize your thoughts, you are not going to be able to think very well. Music is delicious. But who was it? Some angry young, I think, rock and roller had this wonderful outburst some years ago, which I should have clipped and written down so I could properly credit him. But he was saying, you know, I hate music, and the reason I hate music is when I see somebody wearing headphones, there's no way they can be thinking about what, you know, the state of the world and how to be a responsible citizen. That's what I mean. I think literacy, the ability to express and to comprehend complex or reasonably complex thought, that's sort of the Roman highway. And things will float along for a while once that no longer becomes anything like a universal talent set. But I think we're in trouble when it becomes something that only a really well-educated elite still has.
And the prison population, because they're reading.
Yeah.
You mentioned responsibility, and that sort of gets at the core of what I was interested in the first question about taste and complacency, the first non-question, the first statement of the words, taste and complacency. I don't see a lot of interest, frankly, in responsibility. I experience a kind of adolescent vibe sometimes out in the world here in the States.
Yeah, for whom would it be cool to be an adult? It's sort of like being a member of the bourgeoisie in Europe. I mean, who wants to hold up their hand and say, "Yeah, I'm bourgeois." You know, yeah, I'm a grown-up, and it's become sort of my mission in life to try to actually feel like an adult.
What has that entailed?
Actually, I had a good dose of it last weekend. One of my nephews, most of my nephews are on the West Coast, but one of them came east to go to college, came and stayed with us for 3 or 4 days in New York. And You know, I had no right to tell him what time to come home, really. I guess I could have, but I was suddenly plunged to see him and his friends kind of off at one end of the room conversing and excluding me. It's like, well, how could you be excluding me? I'm an adolescent, too. I should be part of this whispered conversation. What do you think? I mean, but of course, you know, to him, I'm a 46-year-old, like, you know. And I have to say, I kind of liked that.
You liked the 46-year-old being excluded part?
I did, actually, sort of. Yeah. Yes, I felt I was ready for that. But I mean, I don't have kids, so it's. I think I would have had some of these experiences far sooner if I did.
When you were a kid, if I can take your nonfiction persona and apply it to your real life, when you were a kid, you were intellectually precocious and enjoyed the company of adults. Is there a switch or a coming into that skin of you've always been 46, only now you really are? Or, I mean, you also, in a fairly recent New Yorker piece called The Retreat, Fellowship, A Youth Minister and Me, the piece ends with belonging. You make it into the inner circle of this particular group, and that's a really cool thing. But at an earlier point in the piece, you said that you were a lot more articulate than you were mature. Did you then spend the time in the company of older folks and just wanting, or was this articulateness, which I lack, the articulateness that I lack?
I'm just so enjoy the fact that you're the one struggling here and not me, because it seemed likely to be the other way around.
Oh, no. My job is to make you feel better. but is it... What was that initial impulse? Well, I'm a teenager too. In any way related to being an actual teenager when you were and being an adult? I mean, like that double experience. Help me out here. Were you having a double experience there of being a teenager and being a 46-year-old in a way that you were having an experience when you were a teenager of being a teenager and feeling like a 46-year-old?
Once I was about 15, I hated adolescence and I hated being young. I wanted to have the full capacities of a grown up. There, I was in doing some of these pieces I've been writing for the New Yorker and that are part of a book I'm supposed to deliver in a month. I've been looking at my very oldest journals, and there are these sort of heartbreaking sentences in them, like, I am hampered by a seeming lack of maturity. So I was a kid who was hungry for an adult world. And I think some of the disappointment I have felt, some of the social rage I have felt, has been related to my arriving finally in adulthood, and people don't respect being an adult anymore. It used to be a really neat thing. Who would want to be a kid when you could be an adult? Adults got to do all these great things, and kids were sort of, you know, puerile. And now you have people who are trying to act like teenagers, and I feel like there was a bait and switch here somehow.
You've been too.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, on that, it's the top of the hour, and so we're going to take a short break. You're listening to WCBN FM, Ann Arbor 88.3. My name is Ashley David. This is The Living Writers Show, and my guest today is Jonathan Franzen. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
we're back. You're listening to The Living Writers Show on WCVN FM Ann Arbor. We were just talking about all the teeny bopper music. Jonathan Franzen is my guest today. Tell us about the teeny bopper music, the appeal. We were talking about music earlier and how people can't possibly be.
Well, you know, if you grow up listening to Johnny Cash, you're kind of a Johnny Cash fan for life. And if you grow up listening to Frank, you know, you're a Sinatra fan for life. So I came of age at a great time, when, you know, you would go out and buy new the vinyl of Elvis Costello and The Clash and The Talking Heads. There was only one significant development after that in popular music, which was rap. You know, that's so I feel very fortunate to have, it was a time of great ferment, and those guys really taught me how to live in some significant way. But unfortunately, I'm saddled with these tastes, and even though I will occasionally find a piece of classical music that I can become really attached to, like Petrushka, I can listen to over and over and over, and a few other things like that. Mostly, I just have these really teeny bopper tastes, and you know, want to hear what all the 19-year-olds are listening to, and it's the joke is on me.
Well, we were talking about before the break about this. Folks don't want to be grown-ups anymore, and help me out here because I'm hopeless. Who is the lead singer of Sonic Youth?
Thurston Moore.
Thurston Moore. There we go. He's sort of the quintessential. I'm never growing up. No, I'm not.
Right.
We're gonna end the show today with a little Sonic Youth.
Good.
Do you think where was the bait and switch? What happened?
Well, I think a lot of things are driven. A lot more is driven by market forces than TV cultural commentators like to admit. You know, we hear about the '60s and the overthrow of the old traditions and, you know, the youth movement and all of that. But really, it's much, much better to sell to kids than it is to sell to grownups, because grownups actually have, they're fixed in their tastes. They're not as open to new products. They actually tend to be more critical. They tend to be less susceptible to needing to see the new movie this weekend. They can say, well, I'll wait in 7 weeks. I'll go see it. Whereas all the kids at the junior high have to talk about it on Monday, and if you haven't seen it, you're ostracized. So there's a sort of a path of least resistance has been followed by the market, by advertising, by the creators of products, and as a result, what passes for a culture, a commercial culture, it has this huge stamp, this kind of rock and roll stamp, even though it's quite grotesque now that to see, you know, the gray beard going rock and roll, you know, it's like, ugh, spare me. Couldn't you like say Schubert? Because everybody wants to be the rebel, and nobody wants to be the rebelled against. And it doesn't add up. It doesn't compute. Not everyone can be the rebel. That's one of the big lies of advertising. It's the big lie of rock and roll as a philosophy, not as a, you know, something to listen to when you're taking a long car drive, but as a kind of mode of existence. It's a big lie. Not everyone can be the rebel. And it's quite thankless to, you know, stand up and say, okay, rebel against me. But I have come to feel like such a freak in so many ways as a writer and as a person who cares about books, that I feel like, well, in for a nickel, in for a buck here. I'll just try to, you know, admit to certain uncoolnesses and go ahead and rebel against me if you want, as a favor to you. Just sort of embrace the weirdness of not fitting in. I never really fit in that well anyway. And that the thing you cited at the end of the essay, the retreat, you know, that's a short-lived feeling of belonging. That's a 10th grader feeling happy. But you can imagine how long that lasted.
Yeah, about less time than it took to write that sentence, I'd say. So you mentioned... Oh, I've just lost my train of thought.
That's okay. I feel like I've been free associating anyway.
So let's just talk about birds for the rest of the show.
Birds, yes.
You have a particularly special place in your heart for birds.
Lately, I've developed a bit of a bird problem. Yes, I've started looking at birds. Reminds me of here's another uncool cultural reference. You have to be a certain age to know that Peanuts, the cartoon strip, was actually phenomenally good for about 15 or 20 years. And in its good phase, before it became a vapid, bad daily strip in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was a great sequence where Linus starts patting birds on the head. And someone finally goes to his sister Lucy and says, you know, your little brother pats birds on the head. And she's like, ah! No. It's like there could be no worse thing to say to her than your little brother pats birds on the head.
Because it was uncool?
Oh, just like what a eccentric dweeb you have for a brother.
Now, were these all birds or ducks? Would he tame wild birds?
No, it's just, I mean, they were, Schultz only really drew a kind of generic bird. He had this actually not very funny cartoon bird and some of that cartoon bird's pals, but whenever needed to draw a wild, unspeaking bird, it was sort of a bluebird-like thing that stood on the ground.
And Linus was petting the bluebirds
saying, pat,
on the
pat,
ground.
Pat, yeah, pat, pat, pat. So yes, actually another Linus referent, he and Charlie Brown are running for president and vice president of their school class, and they have it sewn up. They've got the thing wrapped up. The polls show them leading. And for his last speech, Linus decides to talk about the Great Pumpkin. I'd like to say a few words about the Great Pumpkin. And you know, everyone just clutches their head because you've just blown it. We actually thought you might be good, and now you're talking about the Great Pumpkin. That's how I feel talking about birds, even though they are great. And what else can I say about them, Ashley?
Well, what I was going to ask you about them was you're heading off to go bird watching while you're in town. Is that the case?
I might go over to Belleville, where there's said to be a reservoir with some gulls on it, with Macklin Smith, who's in the English department here, and a really outstanding birder.
And is it the seeing of birds that you haven't seen before that's the object? Well, I guess what I'm after is what's the object of bird watching? How did it catch you?
Oh, well, it's like saying, what's the object of a good meal, you know?
But, I mean, there's a difference between a good meal and a Sony PlayStation. And for some, a good meal is attractive, and for others, a Sony PlayStation is. And there must have been some trigger that got you into birds. Or was it Linus?
No, it was not. It had nothing to do with that. I'm a bit at a loss because I just published about 13,000 words answering this question and trying to compress it stumblingly into a sentence uttered with increasing self-consciousness in this radio studio is a little tricky. They're really beautiful and they're really wild. They fly. They're dinosaurs, basically. They're what the dinosaurs decided to do. They turned into these feathered things. Do we have 1 minute? I can read my paragraph about why birds are so cool.
Let's
here.
Do it.
Because God knows I'm not going to say it as well. Changing my character. I'm just flipping through the pages here. I'm almost there. We go past my mother's death.
Well, Jonathan is flipping through the pages to get past his mother's death to find the paragraph. Let me tell you that he will be reading nonfiction tomorrow night, Thursday night, at the Rackham Amphitheater at 5 p.m. Now, paragraph?
He might even be reading some of this very essay. Birds were what became of dinosaurs. Those mountains of flesh whose petrified bones were on display at the Museum of Natural History had done some brilliant retooling over the ages and could now be found living in the form of orioles and the sycamores across the street. As solution to the problem of earthly existence, the dinosaurs have been pretty great, but blue-headed vireos and yellow warblers and white-throated sparrows, feather-light, hollow-boned, full of song, were even greater. Birds were like dinosaurs' better selves. They had short lives and long summers. We all should be so lucky as to leave behind such heirs.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's a good way to end the show. It's been a real pleasure to have you on today. You've been tuned into the Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My guest today has been Jonathan Franzen. We've been talking about, just about anything. And next week, my guest will be John McCain. That would be the Senator John McCain.
John McCain.
He writes some books. And so please tune in next week as well. The Living Writers Show is every Wednesday from 4:30 to 5:15. And stay tuned to WCBN. The sports report is next. Thank you to our engineer, Chaz Barrett, for doing such a great job. And thank you to my guest, Jonathan Franzen, for stopping by today.
My great pleasure.
We'll be back next week.